I'm Judy Swallow in Padick Gordon. This is The Connection. God has planted in every human heart the desire to live in freedom, and even when that desire is crushed by tyranny for decades, it will rise again. With those words, President Bush launched his plan for democratic reform throughout the Middle East. Among the goals, free elections, free markets, free press, free labor unions. Iraq would provide the beacon, a shining light to transform this most troubled part of the world. 5 months on from the State of the Union, the rhetoric at the G8 is a little less ambitious. The aim now is to, quote, maintain dialogue about economic and political reform with people in the region. That's diplomatic speak for not forcing change on the leaders in the Middle East. After all, Egypt, Saudi Arabia and Morocco may be close friends of the US, but all declined their invitations to Georgia. Not that these unelected regimes are averse to democracy, you understand, but given the Arab fury over Palestinians and Iraq, Arab leaders would rather avoid a photo op with President Bush. Connection listeners, does the US still have a role in the Middle East? Is President Bush's more modest and multilateral approach a sign of statesmanship or despair? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this hour from Washington by Tamara Wittes. She's a research fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and she's currently working on a book on America's democracy promotion in the Middle East. Welcome. Also from the same studio, Abdulmanam Saeed Ali. He's director of the Al-Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Cairo, but he's currently a research fellow at Brookings. Welcome to you both, but I'd like to turn first to James Harding. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He's covering the G8 summit in Georgia. James, welcome to you too. What exactly have they agreed?
Well, frankly, very little. As you remember, after the president gave that speech that you quoted, his officials fanned out around the world to promote what was then called the Greater Middle East Initiative. And since then, they've shied away from that name. I think they feared it sounded a little imperial. And it's now the Broader Middle East Initiative. And the grand plans have been diluted essentially, or reduced essentially down to one, the Freedom Forum Initiative, which is the main idea now, which is to try and create a forum in which the leaders of the region will get together with leaders of the G8 countries. And this is not to have a summit, but to have a ministerial level set of meetings. There are a bunch of other things as well. They want to encourage business to and civil society to back discussions about democratic reform. But the big sweeping initiative, the idea that Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, first touted last summer and the president got behind towards the end of last year, much of that, those hopes for sweeping changes encouraged by the U.S. have backed off. And I think the mood was really set by Mr. Bush yesterday, who told people at lunch, you will write your history. We are there to support it. It's very clear that they see their role as a supporting one now.
Have they even set a date for the first gathering of this new Freedom Forum?
Yeah, the plan for that is that it happens at the end of the year. But it's really being greeted much more skeptically. Obviously, as you say, there was great skepticism in the region that the U.S. And America's allies were going to try and impose political reform from the outside. Washington has backed away from that in a serious way. But now I think there's even skepticism about the extent to which the U.S. can foster democratic reform from the outside, encourage it. It was quite interesting after the lunch and then the meeting between President Bush and Sheikh Ghazi al-Yawar, the new Iraqi president of the interim government there. A senior U.S. official came back and was really peppered with very skeptical questions, particularly from the members of the Arab media. An Al Jazeera correspondent asked him, is this going to be like Alcoholics Anonymous for the region? Is this going to be, you all get together and say, hi, I'm a dictator, but I really want to change? And then another person asked, I thought, a very important question, which is, how are U.S.-backed reformers in the region going to be protected from repressive governments? How are you going to ensure that once you start something, you're there and follow through? So there's a great deal of anxiety about this initiative, even though it has been diluted down.
Was it all poisoned by the fact that Saudi Arabia and Egypt led the stay away, James? Because they're the giants in the region. They are far from democracies, but both are slightly immune from fierce U.S. criticism, aren't they?
Well, I think I think that Egypt had an excuse, that, you know, that Mubarak had been here recently. The absence of Saudi Arabia and the absence of Saudi Arabia from the conversations in the last 36 hours in Sea Island is really extraordinary and quite disconcerting, given the focus at the moment on oil, given the recent security problems there have been in Saudi Arabia, the extent to which the G8 leaders seem to have been happy not to talk about Saudi Arabia does present a very serious problem.
Is there any implementation clause in this document? You know, we commit ourselves to promoting reform in the greater Middle, in the broader Middle East and North Africa. I mean, is there any actual, this is what we have to do? Is there any onus on anybody to meet the terms of this document?
No. I mean, the President and the White House are very keen to cast this as a generational commitment. So there's no hurry to achieve things. I think what's interesting is that One of the things that has come out of this summit is the extent to which there are real differences between France and the U.S., and these go beyond Iraq. And clearly, France has a very different view of the way in which change should happen in that region to the U.S. one. And I think the U.S. officials feel as though that French view is rather pessimistic about the capacity for change. And I think the French view is that the U.S. one is overly sunny, believes that goodwill and an injection of cash and business impetus is going to be a spur to reform. So there are differences, I guess, in predisposition much more than in terms of implementation. Because, as I say, there's really not that much to implement given what we thought the Greater Middle East Initiative would be and what the broader Middle East Initiative has turned out to be.
James Harding, Washington Bureau Chief of the Financial Times, currently at the G8 Summit in Georgia. Thank you. Well, he was talking there about the change of rhetoric, the change of tone between the State of the Union and what's being said at the G8. So let's actually hear the oral evidence. Here is President Bush speaking at the State of the Union in January.
We also hear doubts that democracy is a realistic goal for the Greater Middle East, where freedom is rare. Yet it is mistaken and condescending to assume that whole cultures and great religions are incompatible with liberty and self-government. I believe that God has planted in every human heart the desire to live in freedom. And even when that desire is crushed by tyranny for decades, it will rise again.
Spool ahead 5 months, and here you've got National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice at a press briefing in the G8 talking about the same subject.
Nobody really believes that democratic development can be somehow forced from the outside. That's simply not the case. But that the Middle East is a region that is in need of change is a view that is shared by everyone who is coming to the summit and certainly by the members of the G8.
So let's turn to our guests in Washington, Tamara Wittes of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings Institution and Abdulmanam Saeed Ali of the Al Ahram Center, but he's currently also at Brookings. Abdulmanam Saeed Ali, I'd like to start with you because you listened to those two expressions there, first from President Bush in January and then from Condoleezza Rice. Do you feel that they're getting it more right now?
I think they are getting closer to it and starting a process. Probably it could be similar to the Helsinki process that was in the 70s, and it affected greatly Eastern and the whole Soviet bloc. So I think first it is coming in an international level. It is a G8. It is not only an American-led initiative. Second, it included many of the Arab initiatives that took place in the past a few months, and it was with the presence of some Arab leader. And more important, it took some of the important observation taken by the regional governments, particularly Egypt, as related to the situation in the conflicts in the region, as well as accepting the diversity of the region. And finally, you know, the organization makeup that came out of this, which is the future forum for the future, is not really a kind of a review process in which you give grades for countries' progress, but a kind of, you know, a collective type of looking at the problems that really stand against making change in the region. So it is a more cooperative and less provocative than it was initially thought of.
Tamara Wittes, do you see this as President Bush renewing his commitment to the Middle East or trying to wash his hands of it?
Oh, I don't think he's trying to wash his hands of it. All indications are that he believes very sincerely what he says about the advancement of liberty being an antidote to extremism in the broader Middle East. And so I do think he sees this as a key part of winning the war on terrorism in the long run. And he's not trying to run away from it at all. But I think what is happening is a bow to reality. If this issue of reform in the Middle East is something that the administration discovered after 9/11 because of the way in which the political stagnation there affected us, over the last year or so, there's been a process of education within the administration in which they've learned a lot more about reform initiatives inside the region, about activists who have been working this issue for many years. And at the same time, the escalation of rhetoric by the Bush administration has given those activists and those reformers, both within governments in the Arab world and outside governments, it's given them a bit more room to talk about the issue. And so it's been an interactive process in a way, and I think the Bush administration's policy has benefited greatly from that.
Abdulmanem Sayed Ali, President Bush was saying in January that the people are yearning for freedom, it is the governments who are holding them down, and of course he offended the Arab leaders in the region. Condoleezza Rice is now saying, no, of course you cannot impose the Western model onto the Arab nations. How will people in your country, in Egypt, regard that? Will they see it that the Bush administration is getting it right now, or that they're selling out to the tyrants that are, who are their allies in the region?
Well, I think the people in the region are skeptical about the credibility of the whole thing, so they will wait and see how that will be turned into policy in different fronts. However, I like to stress that neither way is really the prevailing one in the region. In the region, we see they are going through a historical process that's different from where we are now, say, in the United States or in Europe. That does not necessarily mean that they could reach this point. But as in any historical process, you have pros and cons, and you have forces for and forces against. And sometimes it's not only governments who are against change, but also societies against change. And societies are against change because of old traditions, because misunderstanding of religion, because they didn't go through a big industrial revolution. So, you know, also socioeconomic plus cultural factors play a role here. Some countries did not establish any kind of institutions like parliaments, like most of the countries of the Gulf until very recently. Some new press only in the last three or four decades. So we are into a process that is very complicated.
And we'll pick up those points right after the break. Abdulmanem Sayed Ali, thanks for to join the conversation on the G8 initiative for the Middle East, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking President Bush's more modest plan for reform in the Middle East presented to the G8 summit this hour. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is how you join the conversation. John joins us from Amherst, New York. Hi, John. What's your point?
Hi, Judy. I'd like to make a comment. Is your guest from Egypt still there?
Oh, they're all here.
They're. I'd really like to kind of not necessarily condemn but criticize him. It appears that George Bush is the only one who has faith in the Muslim people. If you look at where the Middle East from Morocco into Saudi Arabia and possibly parts east, These are all run by totalitarian regimes. Even Egypt, I will say, has more of a king than a president, because they're actually talking about Hosni Mubarak's son taking over. So for him to be criticized, George Bush, I speak specifically of, because he has faith in the Muslim people, I just think it's very ironic. And for him to be pilloried like he is, I think it's just, you know, this man from Egypt is a spokesman for the Egyptian government.
I don't think we're pillaring George Bush. Let me put that to Abdelmanem Saeed Ali. Yeah. Abdelmanem Saeed Ali, why are there no democracies virtually throughout the Middle East so that you even get not only royal families but hereditary republics?
You have hereditary republics only in one case. That's the Syrian case, which is really a dictatorship.
Well, but, John pointed out Egypt might be heading that way.
Absolutely no. You know, I can make the statement, this rumors is only in the United States. There is no chance that the president's son will be the president of Egypt. And Egypt have a lot of faults, but for sure it is not a totalitarian regime. I mean, the president have no whimsical ability to make laws. Laws goes through parliament. We have a high constitutional court that annulled 208 laws to the president in the past 20 years.
Okay, well, let's look at the broader picture then. John is pointing out that there is no democratically elected leadership. Are the people in the Middle East relying on President Bush to actually nurture that democracy along? Is the U.S. playing a vital role here?
It's playing a vital role, yes, but relying on President Bush, I doubt that very much. Actually, the credibility and the reputation of President Bush in the region is very low at this stage. But I also differ with those who say that he is standing against the Muslim world or he is the one that will make change. I think, unless it is a very cooperative effort between reformers and the United States and the Europeans, I don't think this venture will not succeed.
John, thanks for your point. And I'd like to put that point from you, saying only President Bush, only the United States is actually doing anything and can do anything to help reform, to nudge along reform in the Middle East. And introduce my next guest, Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist magazine. I presume you're joining us from London, Bill. Is that true that the U.S. is the only one who can do it?
I think it's true that nobody can do it on their own. I think it's, though, also true that the one country that is willing to stand up and say where it thinks things should go is the United States. To a lesser extent, Britain, but basically the United States is the one with the stature to do it. What has changed, though, in the last 12 months is that chaos in Iraq has limited the credibility of such statements from President Bush, and therefore he has sensibly, I think, toned them down. And we now wait to see what really happens in Iraq and then what follows from that. If America succeeds in creating a democracy in Iraq, that will hugely strengthen its position in the rest of the Middle East. And, of course, nobody else is trying to do that.
Do you think the European members of the G8 are going along with the U.S. with gritted teeth? Because this is not the European approach, is it? A broad sweep taking in everyone from Pakistan right across to Morocco.
No, it isn't. I think the Europeans don't feel comfortable with such expansive statements and expansive ways of doing things. They also feel nervous about the sort of potential instability that could come if one tried to push and cajole things along too rapidly. And finally, they have the sort of luxury of not being really directly responsible, which means that they can stand on the sidelines criticizing.
And didn't they anyway have their own plan launched in about 1995, I think, the Barcelona plan, which was a series of bilateral ideas for each country in the region? I mean, has that been thrown away because of the G8, or are they just signing up to this to placate George Bush?
I'm sure that in some pigeonhole in governments around Europe, the Barcelona plan still exists, but nobody remembers what it actually was. I don't think that it's going to be there in history as a great initiative.
Nonetheless, we've got today the European Union Commission, Chris Patten, the Foreign Affairs Commissioner, launching a new blueprint for democracy in Iraq. Is the EU working in conjunction with the US? Or, given what we've seen between President Chirac and President Bush at the G8, is there still a sort of rivalry there?
Oh, definitely. There's rivalry there. I think these are human beings. They have pride as well as a sense of superiority complexes on both sides, this is, and so they certainly have a rivalry. I don't think that they any longer actively want to disrupt what's going on in Iraq. They don't actively want to ruin America's plans, which was to some degree the fact before the invasion of Iraq. But nevertheless, there's definitely rivalry.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Larry's joining us from Canton, New York. Hi, Larry. What do you want to ask the guests?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Say, I'm a little concerned about the emphasis on democracy without it being linked to a broader principle of individual liberty. Seems like we're suggesting that they're equal, and democracy without individual liberty as a basis in principle, I think, can go awry rather quickly. I wonder if your guests could comment upon that.
Certainly. Abdelmonem Saeed Ali, would you go along with that, that the Western democratic model is not perhaps the right one for the Middle East?
No, I think it is the right one. The issue is when and what are the conditions that this I consider the Western model as a universal model, but it has different types of applications and different types, I will say, of timing. You need a socioeconomic middle class large enough to sustain both personal freedoms and also democratic institutions. You need a kind of an open culture that really absorb and dialogue and engage with other cultures, not only isolated ones. You have to assimilate tribes to be part of nations, not necessarily a kind of identity of its own. You need to consolidate the nation state. I mean, there is a lot of conditions and prerequisites for the Western model that some of it is already there for some countries or for others relatively there. Others, they don't exist at all. And so the whole thing needs a handling that's based on the diversity of the entire region.
Tamara Wishes, is that the U.S. big fear that has maybe made President Bush pull back? The lessons of Iraq is that if you allow a certain degree of freedom, the forces that rise up are religion, are tribal, are nationalism, rather than what they might hope for, which is this sort of quiescent academic middle class who would take over and create a wonderful, peaceful democracy.
Well, there's no question that the fear that an opening up of political systems in the region might bring radical nationalist or radical religious forces to the fore, that's a fear that concerns not only the U.S. and European governments, but also the existing governments in the region, of course. And I think none of us want to see this process produce greater radicalism. But I think the experience in Iraq actually has been helpful for the United States, whereas before it had almost an allergy to the notion of religious parties playing a role in open politics. In 1992, when the Islamic Salvation Front was poised to win the Algerian parliamentary elections, the U.S. supported a military coup to overthrow that result. But in Iraq, the U.S. has worked very closely with religious parties in the negotiations over the transitional government. And I actually think that that experience is going to help the United States learn some lessons about how to work with religious parties that that can be moderate and productive forces in the democratic process, as, for example, the Christian democratic parties are in Europe.
Abdelmonem Saeed Ali, we often hear of the Algerian example. Was that a massive mistake by the West to not allow the Islamist Feast to win that election? It's sort of, yes, you can have democracy, but only on our terms.
Well, it's very difficult to do history twice, once to have it this way and once his way, so which one is better? But I prefer that we deal with the result. I think, first of all, it would have been possible at least to have a more competitive Algerian scene than the one we got in 1992 before the elections. And that's one of the things that we want to do now in dealing with reforms in the Middle East, that to create the condition that made the religious parties or religious democratic parties have a chance but not dominating the political scene. So there is a lot to learn from the Algerian experience. I will say it was possible that we will have a real religious dictatorship. There was tendencies within the FIS, which is a religious party, that really was very totalitarian. The other were our liberals. And we have to work out which ones that they should be encouraged and giving more a chance that they play a larger political role. But as Tamara just said, actually the Iraq experience, we have the Dawa Party, we have Muslim Brothers Party in the Iraqi Governing Council before. They are active now in the Iraqi political scene, but they are part of a multiplicity of parties and trends, so they balance each other. The problem when you have only one dominating party, that affect democracy even at the best of democratic countries.
Well, Bill Emmett of The Economist, I mean, wasn't it the case certainly with Algeria that France was the leading pusher for not allowing FIS to win? What is the European view of extremism? Is it keep it down or let it out very, very slowly?
I don't think that there's a coherent European view of this. I think it is accepted that it is a very difficult issue to deal with, but also that it was a mistake, both for the Algerian government to accept that nudging from France and for France to do the nudging in the first place. With hindsight, given what happened in Algeria, the tragedy that happened during the 1990s, that it was a mistake. But I don't think anybody now feels that they've got a clear blueprint for how to deal with extremism following that mistake. Nor should anyone think that they've got a clear blueprint for introducing democracy generally. I think the important thing is patience and a realization that this doesn't take 12 months. It takes perhaps many years.
Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist magazine, thanks for joining us. I'd like to turn quickly to Tamara Wittes. Tamara, is it just Saudi Arabia that has America very worried? You know, if you let the reins of freedom loose, I think I probably mixed my metaphor, but if you allow freedom to rise, that Saudi Arabia could be the one that would explode.
Well, I think that there are certainly some rulers in the region that are putting forward the notion, you know, after me, the storm. And if you push too hard on democracy, you'll get chaos as a result. And I think that it's proper for the U.S. and other Western governments interested in promoting democracy to push back against that assumption a bit. At the same time, there's no question that the government in Saudi Arabia is facing a significant internal challenge from not just radical political forces, but violent insurgents who are attempting to overthrow the regime there. And so there's a military dimension to this and not just a political dimension. I think Abdelmonem's point that in order to control the effects of open politics, you need to have diversity in your political system. That's really the key. You need to have a society in which there is freedom to organize political parties, to meet, to discuss different ideas and different platforms. Right now, in most countries in the region, the only social institutions that can operate relatively free of government interference are religious institutions, and that is why the Islamist opposition movements are as strong as they are. There isn't really much of an alternative. So I think it takes time to create that alternative, but you do need to press governments to open up enough to allow those alternatives to emerge.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Miriam's calling from Newton, Mass. Hi, Miriam. What's your point?
I have a point that I would like a comment on.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I question the credibility of this particular administration attempting to bring democracy to the Middle East. This is an administration whose own attorney general is now being considered to be held in contempt of Congress, who was reprimanded by a senator who told him, your opinion is not the law, This is a government by law, I would like to remind you. This is an administration that has whitewashed allegations against it and the evidence against it of having broken international law, and that persuaded its own people to go into a war on false assumptions. How can such an administration, which is represents the supposedly greatest democracy in the world, be talking about bringing democracy to the Middle East?
Abdelmanam Saeed Ali, is that true, Miriam's point, that a lot in the Arab and Muslim world are going to be saying, because of Ashcroft talking about torture and because of what happened at Abu Ghraib, hypocrites, this is not the sort of freedom we expected from the U.S.?
I think that the United States is all this allegation that was said is very prevailing in the Middle East and in many American quarters as well. However, I think what is the advantage of the United States is two things. One, its ability to re-educate itself. And I think the United States went in the past few months into a process of education. Number two, that there is an ability for correction. There is a coming elections, and when, you know, an administration make a big mistake, then it will be voted out of the office. So these two advantages with the United States, and particularly the big media and think tanking mills in this country, I think they are a correction mechanism that can help. And but certainly many of the views that was mentioned is quite prevailing in the Middle East, as well as they have a lot of merits. I think the United States now has a sense of modesty regarding the Middle East than it was, say, a year ago.
Hasn't this played right into the hands of the unelected leaders?
Not really. You know, I think now in the Middle East, reform is in the agenda. It was. I think for a country like Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Lebanon, Sudan, even countries like Algeria as well, and now there is Iraq, and in countries of the Gulf region, the reform movement has been active, I would say, in the last 20 years or so. They got a big push after the second Gulf War and now after the third Gulf War.
Connection listeners, what do you think? Does the U.S. still have a critical role to play in the Middle East, or is the G8 the moment when they're admitting they're butting out? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking the new, slightly watered-down Middle East initiative unveiled at the G8 by President Bush this hour. Connection listeners, do you see new signs of modesty in the U.S. approach to the Middle East? And is that a good thing? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests this hour are Tamara Witters of the Brookings Institution and Abdelmanam Saeed Ali of the Al-Akhram Center in Cairo, but he's also currently at the Brookings Institution. Before we go to the calls, I'd like to look quickly at the document, because Abdelmanam Saeed Ali, there are some changes, aren't there, to this. For a start, it mentions explicitly the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, says it must be solved, and also says it must be solved on the basis of 242 and 338, which are the UN resolutions saying end the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Huge concessions, do you not think?
I don't see them as conditions. I see them
concessions,
as...
I said.
I don't see them as concessions. I see them as more understanding of the situation in the region and as a product of the dialogue that took place in the past few weeks. Outside of the media, you know, kind of usually stress on conflicts, there was big consultations taking place. And I believe many of the Arab and I will say particularly Egyptian views were taken. It was a lot of things was noted. You referred to the Barcelona process into consideration. Many in the United States government don't know or know very little about this initiative. It is active, by the way, and this initiative already there is signing of agreements that took place with six countries in the region, and it has broad reformist implication, whether it's economic or political, and it's functioning for over now or almost 10 years. So I believe this document is one of can be an example in a way that international dialogue matters, that when you consult, then you can come up with a better document that can be at least acceptable or understood by many of the parties concerned.
Tamara Wishes, if I can be a pedant about this, if you look at item 5.3, which also refers to the Palestinians, it says regional conflicts must not be an obstacle for reform. Is that throwing down the gauntlet a bit to Arab regimes? Because the Palestinians and on the Arab street, they will say that their leaders have always used the Palestinian issue as an excuse for not reforming.
I think if you take these two statements together, what you see is actually just a commitment on the part of the G8 states to get over what had become a very sterile debate about which needed to come first, a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute or reform in the region. Essentially, the G8 states are trying to set this aside by saying Israel-Palestine is important, but it's not everything, and we have to move forward on both these things at once. And I would say, by the way, that there are Arab leaders who echo this perspective as well. The Emir of Qatar just the other day, which is a small Gulf state, essentially made the same point and said, look, it might take another 20 years to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, and we just can't afford to wait that long. That actually gets to something very significant, which is that change in this region is being internally generated, whether the G8 has something to say about it or not. The tremendous youthful population in the region means that these states have to come up with 5 million new jobs a year just to find a place for people. The economies are stagnated in many cases. The educational systems are not giving people the skills they need to find work. And so I think everybody recognizes the need for change. The question is how, and whether the G8 can play a positive role and not just a role of nitpicking from the outside.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Frederic is calling from Brookline, Mass. Frederic, your point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm originally from Algeria, and I was driving and I had to pull over and call your program. It gets my blood boiling when I hear people talking about the canceling of the elections in Algeria and saying how bad of a thing it was. I just would like to remind people that the Islamist Party was a party that was playing the democratic role to get to power, to eliminate any kind of democratic way in Algeria. This is the party that started the killing of women and children, slaughtering of women and children. And one of the your panelists said that the United States was against the canceling. Quite in the contrary, the United States was actually given at that time political asylum to the leaders of that party.
Tell me, you are pleased that the FIS was not allowed to come into power, but Algeria was left with this, so what they call le pouvoir, this unholy alliance between the political leadership and the military. I would assume that they're not that much better. How would you like to see the U.S. changing things in Algeria?
Well, by being on the right side of history, I would say, not undermining any democratical process in Algeria. I think democracy has to come from within, and if the people of Algeria decided that they didn't want an Islamist theocracy in place, to let them do so.
Frederic, thanks very much for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's hear from Rekia in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Rekia, your point.
Yes, my point is that how George Bush is going to have a critical role to play in the Middle East when his action speaks louder, and this is the president that he's aiding all these dictators of the Middle East that, you know, against the people's will. If it wouldn't be for our aid to those dictators, we would see democracy reform on all type of change in the Middle East. And then another thing, and this is the president that refused to prevent General Boykins when he said the U.S. Army is the army of God and the Muslim the Muslims are the army of Satan, and we have to go to war to, on them in the name of Jesus. And he said that in uniform in his congregation, and this is a Christian fundamentalist who is a general. And then you see the result of that, of all the torture in Abu Ghraib and everywhere else. And then you cannot just choose people, their governments, and say, okay, this is democracy in case of Iraq, Afghanistan, and all over the Muslim world. And then again, and this is the president said himself, this is the war of crusade, where the Muslim world see him as a modern crusader. And you have to win the people's minds and heart first in order to do reforms. Again, and look at the Guantanamo Bay, and Muslims are detained with no charge indefinitely.
Okay, Reiki, that's a lot of points there. What I'd like to know is what countries in particular do you think that the U.S. is propping up unsavory regimes?
Well, in case of Egypt, and look at the Palestinians issue, Sharon, you know, how much do we aid them? Maybe a billion a month or every 2 months. And the condition at the Palestinians, they have no homes, their homes are being demolished. And all the torture that you see in the Middle East, it is a result of our foreign policy.
Reikia, thanks very much for your point. Tamara Wittes, is there a problem? There are certain leaders in the Middle East the U.S. cannot afford to lose, like President Mubarak.
Well, there's no question that the U.S. faces a real conflict between its short-term interests in cooperating with these governments on issues like the Middle East peace process, like fighting Al-Qaeda and shutting down terrorist financing, and our long-term interest in promoting democracy. These things definitely run into one another. And I think what President Bush has tried to do is lay down a marker, most recently in his speech at the Air Force Academy commencement a couple of weeks ago, and saying we will be expecting more from our friends in the region than we have in the past. I think it's fine to do that, but on a case-by-case basis, if, for example, an Arab leader arrests dissidents and claims that they're terrorists, are we going to condemn or not? And that's a very tough choice for us.
Abdelmanem Said Ali, how much of a problem is it, this word crusade in the Middle East? We heard Reiki there mentioning the Boykin affair. Is that still the perception in the Middle East that the U.S. is too close to Israel?
Well, I think it is a strong perception even in the United States. However, I want to make here two points, that the United States is giving Egypt less than 5% of its foreign earnings. So it is not a big thing that sustain a government or something. There is an illusion here in this country about it. Number two, I think I want to stress that nobody really in this world is perfect. The United States make mistakes and Egypt make mistakes. And the issue is how to handle this. And as Tamara said, we have always a conflict between short-term interest and long-term.
But is the perception in the Middle East that President Bush made a mistake when he backed Sharon's Gaza plan?
Because I will say he made a big mistake. And actually, the letter he gave to Sharon, in which he expanded, you know, or give the Israel rights for things that's subject for negotiations, in case that's to win a vote by a part of the Likud party. I think that was a big mistake that complicated the whole process.
A final point from Kathy, who's calling us from Hermitage in Tennessee. Hi, Kathy, your point.
Yeah, I lived in Morocco as a child, and I go back every year, and I stay in homes with very average working people, poor people, some of them, and I never hear them asking for sweeping democratic change. They would just like to see some corruption halted. They'd like to be able to go get the house, the papers they need for their house, or to drive a car without paying a bribe to someone. They'd like to know that the police aren't going to be stopping them all the time and asking for money. You know, if they could just maybe pay the police a little more, where they don't feel like they have to be asking for bribes, put some kind of controls on that. I have a Moroccan friend who moved here. She was so thrilled to go to immigration office and stand in line, wait for her papers, and be treated just like everyone else with respect and dignity and not be asked for money under the table to move her paperwork forward. And these are little things I think a country could do. I mean, they were so full of hope when Mohammed VI became king. And already they're so disillusioned. They see him doing nothing to change anything for them.
Kathy, thanks very much for that point. Abdulmanam Said Ali, is that true that, you know, Arabs, or many Arabs, would rather just have little things in their lives improved? I know often when you talk to Palestinians, they say, we don't need another grand plan, just make our daily lives a little bit better. Is that the call from the Arab street?
No, I think the Arab street, they wake up in the morning and send kids to school and then go to work and try to hard to make a living. I mean, usually in countries, those who are politically alert, they try, you know, to move things forward. So not everybody, of course. The Arab street is busy of living. This word of Arab street, that people are crowded and mobbing in the street, shouting for politics all the time, is really a television view. We have 300 million people, you can say, the politically active with them are less than a million. And the rest is really busy with their lives. So the little things, governance things, that's referred to by your caller, I think she has a point there, that people who want better police station, better standards of living. But also there is an elite that want that to work for their coming generation, that some of our countries are mature enough to have a better form of governance. And as I said, it's different from one country to another. You can't compare Egypt with Saudi Arabia, with Lebanon, where you have different levels of modernization, institutionalization, political parties, role of the media, to the rest of all the components of a modern democratic society.
Tamara Wittes, is that the lesson from Iraq? There's been a lot of cynicism about what's happened at G8, but do you think what's happened there is that maybe the Bush administration has come round to the view that you need small steps first, not this huge grand vision of imposed democracy? Give people jobs, make them feel important, build up from the grassroots. Good idea?
Well, I think there's no question that if you can give people a better standard of living, a reliable income, if you can give them hope for the future, then they have the ability to take a deep breath and look around them and decide what they want for themselves. But it seems to me that there's a lot of overlap between these tiny steps and the broader notion of democracy and expanding liberty. Because, you know, if you're trying to get rid of corruption, what you need is a good judicial system. So it all wraps up together, the micro and the macro.
Tamara Wittes of the Brookings Institution, thanks. Thank you, too, to Abdulmanam Said Ali of the Al-Akhram Center, but currently at the Brookings Center. So our special thanks to the Brookings Institution for technical assistance with today's show. Thanks also to my other guests, Bill Emmett of The Economist magazine and James Hardings of The Washington Times in Georgia. Tara Murphy's a senior producer of The Connection. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.